Good morning. I'd like for you to turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 23. We looked last week at chapter 22, which has as a conclusion one of the darkest times in the history of the covenant promises to David. And yet, as I think was pointed out so well, couldn't really be dark at all, but only a time in which God's glory and faithfulness are shown very clearly. So with that destruction by Athaliah of the seed royal, almost, we find the restoration of the true Davidic rule in chapter 23, and I'd like to read that. It might stay warmer if someone could close that door. I think it's a little drafty in the hallway. Thank you. Actually, I think I'll read the last verse of chapter 22, which gives you at least the context a little bit. And he, that is Joash, this boy, 1 year old, was hidden with them in the house of God for 6 years while Athaliah reigned over the land. Chapter 23. In the seventh year Jehoiada strengthened himself and made a covenant with the captains of hundreds, Azariah the son of Jeroham, Ishmael the son of Jehohanan, Azariah the son of Oded, Maaseiah the son of Adiah, and Elishaphat the son of Zichri. And they went throughout Judah and gathered the Levites from all the cities of Judah and the chief fathers of Israel, and they came to Jerusalem. Then all the assembly made a covenant with the king in the house of God. And he said to them, "Behold, the king's son shall reign, as the Lord has said of the sons of David. This is what you shall do. One-third of you entering on the Sabbath of the priests and the Levites shall be keeping watch over the doors. One-third shall be at the king's house, and one-third at the gate of the foundation. All the people shall be in the courts of the house of the Lord. But let no one come into the house of the Lord except the priests and those of the Levites who serve. They may go in, for they are holy, but all the people shall keep the watch of the Lord. The Levites shall surround the king on all sides, every man with his weapons in his hand, and whoever comes into the house, let him be put to death. You are to be with the king when he comes in and when he goes out." So the Levites and all Judah did according to all that Jehoiada the priest commanded. Each man took his men who were to be on duty on the Sabbath with those who were going off duty on the Sabbath, for Jehoiada the priest had not dismissed the divisions. And Jehoiada the priest gave to the captains of hundreds the spears and the large and small shields which had belonged to King David that were in the temple of God. Then he set all the people, every man with his weapon in his hand, from the right side of the temple to the left side of the temple, along by the altar and by the temple, all around the king. They brought out the king's son, put the crown on him, gave him the testimony, and made him king. Then Jehoiada and his sons anointed him and said, "Long live the king." Now when Athaliah heard the noise of the people running and praising the king, she came to the people in the temple of the Lord. When she looked, there was the king standing by the pillar, by his pillar at the entrance, and the leaders and the trumpeters were by the king. And all the people of the land were rejoicing and blowing trumpets, also the singers with musical instruments, and those who led in praise. So Athaliah tore her clothes and said, "Treason! Treason!" And Jehoiada the priest brought out the captains of hundreds who were set over the army and said to them, "Take her outside under guard and slay with the sword whoever follows her." For the priest had said, "Do not kill her in the house of the Lord." So they seized her, and she went by way of the entrance of the house gate into the king's house, and they killed her there. And Jehoiada made a covenant between himself, the people, and the king, that they should be the Lord's people. And all the people went to the temple of Baal and tore it down. They broke in pieces its altars and images and killed Mattan, the priest of Baal, before the altars. Also Jehoiada appointed the oversight of the house of the Lord to the hands of the priests, the Levites, whom David had assigned in the house of the Lord, to offer the burnt offerings of the Lord, as it is written in the law of Moses, with rejoicing and with singing, as it was established by David. And he set the gatekeepers at the gates of the house of the Lord, so that no one who was in any way unclean should enter. Then he took the captains of hundreds, the nobles, the governors of the people, and all the people of the land, and brought the king down from the house of the Lord. And they went through the upper gate to the king's house, and set the king on the throne of the kingdom. So all the people of the land rejoiced, and the city was quiet, for they had slain Athaliah with the sword. Now this is one of many, I guess, exciting chapters in the book of Chronicles that's full of not only excitement, but very helpful lessons, and is very relevant even, I think, to the way in which civil government should be established. We'll see if we get to that at the end. But I'd like to make a couple of comments just to preface this. Joash is the boy king here. We saw in the last chapter that he was hidden away by the wife of Jehoiada, the priest, who was also a daughter of Joash's father, whether they were brother and sister or somehow stepbrother and sister is another question, but I'm sorry, this would have been his aunt. I got the generations wrong. Anyway, he was hidden away and protected, and for a period of several years here, as it says at the end of 2 Chronicles 22, for 6 years Athaliah ruled. Athaliah is never treated as a proper ruler. She's not a queen. She's given no description of when she started ruling, how long her rule was, you know, who her parents were, and so forth. There's a standard description, as we discussed last week, and she gets none of that. She's a usurper. She murders the rightful heirs to the throne, attempts to murder them all. And it's during this period, then, that the king is hidden away, that apparently Jehoiada is planning what goes on in this chapter. Now, there's a parallel account, as there is for much of Chronicles, in Kings, in this case, 2 Kings chapter 11, and I won't be reading that, but Chronicles, 2 Chronicles 23 in that chapter in 2 Kings are very closely parallel, but there's some extra information in Chronicles that is in accordance with the special emphasis the chronicler has on the work of the priests and the Levites. And there are also some things that I'd like to bring in from Kings as we go through. Okay. Another note about names. We've seen some confusion before. Joash is also called Jehoash, just an abbreviation of the name to be Joash. And especially in Kings, you find that prominent. So refer to your handy table. He's called Jehoash there, I think. But it's the same fellow. He ruled, as we see in chapter 24, verse 1, for 40 years. He started ruling when he was 7 years old. That means he was hidden away about at the age of one. And certainly he had a nurse, as it was referred to in 2 Chronicles 22. So he started ruling at the age of seven and ruled for about 40 years. What we'll be seeing here and in the first part of chapter 24 are the, shall we say, the happier parts of Joash's reign, until Jehoiada dies, and then things go downhill. But I don't want to get, I don't want to tarnish this. It's a great and encouraging part that we're reading here, so we don't have to look ahead to what actually happens at this point. So that's something of the background of what's going on here. Jehoiada is called the priest. Probably he is the high priest, but that's not said specifically as far as I know. He certainly has a prominent role in what goes on here. And that, I guess, leads me to the first, maybe a bit of an aside. There's several issues which come up in the chapter which are kind of interesting and somewhat unusual. And some of them I'll try to deal with as we go through. But one in particular about the way in which there was a covenant not just between the king and the Lord, but also between the king and the people. Now, that's what I had in mind, especially when I said this was relevant to the way civil government should be established. That particular point I'd like to put off till the end, because there's always more time at the end, at least when you're at the beginning. Anyway, so that particular point I don't want to bring up now. But you'll notice the way Jehoiada proceeds here may raise some questions, and that this sort of thing comes up, as we've already discussed before. There was a biblical separation of church and state in the Old Testament, in the sense that the king could not usurp the priestly role, and the priests had their own duties and assignments. So it may seem a little bit unusual what it is that Jehoiada is doing here. I'll make a few comments about that in just a minute, but let's just at least look at the beginning to see what he did do. His plan is to call together, first of all, rulers from various spheres. And so you see mentioned here, first of all, that he makes a covenant, at least that's the way the New King James has it, made a covenant with the captains of hundreds. And there are some names listed there. These are probably military men, perhaps in the royal guard. There's a possibility that they were Levitical leaders who also had partly a military responsibility. But it's likely that these were men who had been involved in the royal guard anyway. And so he calls these men together, and they in turn are sent throughout Judah, it says in verse 2. And they gather together different groups. You see in verse 2, first of all, a reference to the Levites from all the cities of Judah, and then the chief fathers of Israel. The chief fathers would have been perhaps what we would call the ruling elders, in the sense that they had some authority in either in the civil or ecclesiastical sphere. It's really hard to say very much about it, and I don't want to press the issue, but these are representatives. I think that's the key point, that they're representatives of various households, or maybe larger units than that, throughout the country. And they come together, and it says in verse 3, all the assembly. So you think about who we have so far. We have these military leaders, we have the Levites, and we have these heads of families gathered together. And this covenant that's mentioned in verse 3 is then between them and the king. And Jehoiada says in verse 3, behold, the king's son shall reign, as the Lord has said of the sons of David. Now, of course, that's hearkening back to the Davidic covenant. He says, the basis for my actions, and not only the basis for my actions, but the hope for my actions, you might say, is the fact that God has promised. It's a very strong statement. He says the king's son must reign. This is not only the way God has commanded it, but of course, in the sense of the outworking of God's providence, the king's son shall reign. This will come about, and God will accomplish it, as the Lord has said of the sons of David. So that's the way things are set up. There's this covenant made, and that's the idea I want to return to later, because this is not the covenant that's referred to later on when they covenant to be the Lord's, but this has to do with an agreement, perhaps initially in terms of the arrangement for the restoration of the king. And yet, as we'll see, it goes beyond that to speak about the limitations on the king's power. In any case, things are set up by gathering together these people. And the same sort of groups are mentioned, if you notice, throughout the chapter. One verse in particular, verse 20, would be helpful here. In verse 20, there's a procession at the end. You notice as we read that, it says, he took the captains of the hundreds, the nobles, the governors of the people, and all the people of the land. So there's similar groups represented there. And the significance of that is, first of all, this wasn't just Jehoiada's idea. Okay, this wasn't a one-man revolution, or I don't think you could really even call it a revolution at all. It was something in which all the people were involved. And I wanted to bring that up because there's a natural question that arises, that is, how is it that a priest could do something like this? And I think the simplest answer is that this is a very unusual situation. And it's not a pattern. The priest wasn't, in a sense, the kingmaker, right? There was a well-established procedure in which the priest did not normally have such a part. And Matthew Poole, in his commentary, said, it's actually a commentary on Kings, but there are other comments on Chronicles also. I thought he said it well. He says, if this action of Jehoiada's seems strange and irregular, this was no ordinary case, but there were diverse peculiar things in it. And he goes on to list several things. Three in particular I mentioned is, first of all, of course, Athaliah was a usurper. They were dealing with a case with a person who had seized the power in an unjust and very irregular way. And second, of course, as we've already mentioned, that the rightful heir to the throne was Joash. The throne was to be in the hands of the sons of David. And the third, thing that puts Jehoiada's actions in a good light is the fact that he did not act on his own, but that he consulted with the various groups, you might say the ecclesiastical power in terms of bringing in the Levites, and also the representatives of the people in terms of whoever the heads of the families were. The military, I think, is there largely to help to help accomplish what needed to be accomplished, but they also would be part of the civil power. And so that, there are questions like that that occur elsewhere in the scriptures. For example, when Elijah leads a massacre of the prophets of Baal. Well, that wasn't the typical prophetic task to go around slaying people, but that was a very unusual situation in which in the northern kingdom things had fallen into ruin. There's a further discussion of this in the whole, the kind of unusual situations that come up but don't militate against separation of church and state in the Old Testament. There's a discussion of this in, interestingly enough, Bonson's book, Theonomy and Christian Ethics, has a whole chapter on separation of church and state. I was surprised. It was very helpful and had a lot of references. And in particular, he discusses this case along the same lines that Matthew Poole does. That may not have been a burning issue for any of you guys, but it is helpful to see what in the Old Testament is a pattern and enduring part of the way God has set it up, and what must have been a response to a very unusual circumstance. And I think that's a helpful distinction. The other comment that I thought I would read was from Matthew Henry. 2 Kings says specifically that Jehoiada showed them the son of David who was there, showed them the one who had been preserved. And that's, of course, implicit even here, right? I mean, they're making a covenant with them. And you can imagine that not all the people of the land would have been in the know that this guy had been preserved. You can imagine for 6 years, this wicked Athaliah ruling over the land, instituting Baal practice. Apparently, as we saw, there was even a temple of Baal in the vicinity. Apparently, they didn't have to travel very far to get to it. And imagine the godly man who had been troubled over the promises given to David. And Matthew Henry, I think, said it very well. He says, "What a pleasing surprise it was to them, who feared that the house and lineage of David were quite cut off, to find such a spark as this in the embers." And it really was, in a sense, only a spark. Here's this 7-year-old kid, and he's supposed to be the king. And yet, by God's mercy, the spark, of course, was preserved in the embers, despite Athaliah's attempt to stamp it out. So that I think, lends something to the excitement of the chapter, the fact that this unknown boy king really was there, and God had preserved and kept his promise. The next part talks about the preparations that are made, but let me pause and see if you have any questions or comments so far. Fine.
I find it curious in that, you know, Athaliah's, when she killed all the heirs, I mean, that was not something I think she premeditated, just her son's dead and I'm going to ensure my power base, and she went out and did it. Politics don't change a lot, so I kind of get the feeling that the nobles or those that really had the power or had the control of the commerce and all that, they didn't really know what's going on. And I almost get the feeling it took 6 years for folks. I mean, it's kind of like, a certain president come in, it takes a while to figure out that maybe we don't like this person and get galvanized to do something about it. I mean, just a woman who happened to be the mother of the king to think that she could all of a sudden control the government seems a little bit far-fetched without the support of the nobles. So I kind of feel like there was, for 6 years, there was confusion. Nobody knew what was going on. It was almost like Joash galvanized this group. I mean, it was something that, their religion was central to who they were.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. It is kind of amazing, although, of course, it's all in God's providence, that there's apparently very little resistance when it came about. At least there's no account in this chapter.
When it finally galvanizes, she had no power at all.
Yeah.
I mean, there weren't any soldiers around her, nobody protecting her, and just
right. Yeah, and at the end, it seems like they're, the last verse, they rejoice the city is quiet because she's dead. And so I think in the end you get the sense that they had suffered and realized what they were.
Verses and Psalms that talk about the unrighteous world.
Right. Yeah. Lisa?
This is maybe a little bit of a tangent, but it struck me that the situation to the the issue of the position of women in the sense that I think of Jehoiada's wife.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that she slipped under the radar is because she's a woman. She's related to the king,
uh-huh.
but Athaliah doesn't bother eliminating her. Maybe she was prominent as well because she is the wife of the high priest or a prominent priest. But she's able, by being a woman and being in her rightful position, which really contrasts with Athaliah, but
yeah.
she's able to save, I mean, she's the one who single-handedly saves this little spark of the line of David.
That's right, yeah. She certainly comes across as the one who, in God's providence, is the means for preserving that. Bruce?
Just following up on Brian's comment, just thinking about, you know, up to this time, it looked like God was doing a good job of preserving this promise he made to David. Everybody knew this promise that was made to David. And if the majority of the people thought that all the descendants were wiped out, it would leave you in a place like, what happened, God? Are you really not able to accomplish what you said you were able to accomplish? I mean, that speaks deep into the very heart. And I think about, you know, when we encounter things that it looks like, you know, God, aren't you on the throne? You know, what's happening here? And then when you see, well, sure enough, God preserved his word after all, that has a powerful galvanizing,
yeah.
because it reaches so deep into who you are and your whole national identity and everything.
Yeah, that's true.
And I'm kind of reminded when Khomeini took over in Iran, I mean, it's very similar to this religious leader. It had, I guess you'd call them the Shah, an unrighteous ruler. He's certainly impressive. But they were, I mean, their religion and their government, their religion aren't separated, similar to Israel's. Where I think you'd be hard pressed to see that happen in America.
Yeah. There's an understatement. unless the Lord changes the hearts of men.
And just one question. It looks to me like Jehoiada killed his mother-in-law, but we're not sure exactly how many wives Azariah had.
Yeah, there's. It seems to me pretty unlikely that, in fact, Jehoshabeah, or however, whatever the name was, there's a short and a longer form, was in fact the daughter of Athaliah. But, they had several wives. Yeah.
Right.
The kings did. So it's probably not his own mother-in-law.
This would be another example of this passage not actually setting precedent.
Thanks, Dave. I'm glad you pointed that out. Hadn't thought of that possibility. Yeah. Okay, a little humor about mothers-in-law and so forth. Now, let's move on. The plan, I guess I will have to speed up here. This is all actually quite interesting. The plan involves, in part, the technical details of how the shifts changed in the service of the temple. And some of the actual details are not completely clear because we don't know how things worked out. But there were people who were going on duty to serve, as well as people who were going off duty. And part of the plan was that those who were going off duty should hang around, should stay in the area. And you see, the temple is, in that sense, then an ideal place in which this should take place. Because there are a lot of people milling around the temple. And in fact, the fact that this covenant that we read already was in the temple would have drawn less suspicion. You would expect to have gatherings of people there. And so, in particular, when it says in verse 4, this is what you shall do. One-third of you entering on the Sabbath of the priests and the Levites shall be keeping watch over the doors. And then it goes on, one-third shall be at various places. He's describing the situation on the Sabbath where there would have been a large group of people there as they changed responsibilities. Now, it's hard to know exactly how many were there, but if you remember back in 1 Chronicles 23, there were 24,000 Levites assigned to the service of the temple. So there could well have been a very large number of people here set up for this. the 24,000 were divided into different groups. I mean, obviously, you didn't have 24,000 people there every time, so they were divided into rotations. I just want to make the point that there could well be a large number of people, but the exact details are not completely clear. So he sets things up, again, surrounding the king, but with a special care that the temple not be defiled. And this is a special emphasis of the chroniclers, that even in the doing of the good thing, they should be careful not to violate the holiness of God's temple, and that those who were not allowed to enter in to the inner parts should not be allowed to do so. And so the description continues then in verses 8 and following. Jehoiada the priest had not dismissed the divisions. That's part of the setup, that they would have many people there. They're armed in verse 9 with some of the weapons which would have been kept in the temple, perhaps dedicated for the service of God. And he sets them up in verse 10 along in a row protecting the king. I'm kind of hurrying here over some of the details of the setup. But then the actual action then that follows is in verse 11. They brought out the king's son, put the crown on him, gave him the testimony, and made him king. Then Jehoiada and his sons anointed him and said, "Long live the king." Now, there are references elsewhere, and I guess I put them down here in Samuel, to the anointing of kings. Apparently, it was not always done. If there was a regular succession, there was perhaps no need for a special act like this. But the fact that they gave him, as it says in verse 11, the testimony is something I'd like to think briefly about. The testimony, that word testimony is used in the book of Exodus. I put the reference up there to talk about the Ten Commandments, the tablets of the testimony, which would have been the tablets in which the Ten Commandments were written. And of course, it's used in the Psalms, Psalm 119, for example, as an equivalent word for God's law. So exactly what the testimony was is perhaps not completely certain, but it seems fairly clear that it had to do with the requirements by which the king was to govern. And you remember in Deuteronomy 17, the king was to take a copy from the priests and the Levites and read out of it regularly so that he would know how he was to rule. And it seems quite likely that's giving of the testimony is a connection with that, although it could also be connected with the agreement that had been made earlier. One British commentator, a contemporary one, says this is the basis for the British practice at the coronation of their kings or queens to give them a copy of the Bible, present them a copy of the Bible. And that's based, he said, on this statement here. Now, again, that the fact that they gave him a testimony is related to this issue of the authority of the civil magistrate and whether he can act, whether he is above the law or under the law. But I'm putting that off for until the end, which is approaching more quickly than I would like. But anyway, it's an interesting statement that they crowned him, but not only did they crown him, this is not a sort of a secular crowning alone, but there is a giving of a testimony, an acknowledgement that he has an obligation to the Lord in the way he rules. That's the action then, and reaction of Athaliah is given in the verses that follow. Athaliah is nearby. You remember that the palace is close to the temple, so that's going on would not be very far removed from where she would be. But part of the way that Jehoiada set it up was that the people who would normally be with her were over at the temple. So, strangely enough, she hears the noise and, perhaps not using her good sense, she just runs over there, apparently without any guard whatsoever. She hears the noise, the people shouting. She runs over there, and she sees, and it's so well described in verse 13, she sees the king standing by his pillar. There are references to the pillar as the place where the king would make the proclamation. So in other words, he looks like a king. Here he is standing here at the place of authority, royal authority. And the leaders and trumpeters, the people are rejoicing and blowing trumpets. This again is the emphasis that the chronicler loves to make again and again, that God's people are to rejoice. We're not supposed to be, you know, this glum, sad people all the time. We're to be glad, especially in a circumstance like this. We're to rejoice in what God has done. And so the people are just rejoicing. And then in a statement of supreme irony. Athaliah tears her clothes and says, "Treason, treason." Can you imagine someone saying treason, treason, when she just tried to kill all the heirs to the throne 6 years before? And yet that is the cheek of the usurper, I guess, you know. She just says, treason, treason. And the response is swift, and David has already pointed out that she is put to death. Jehoiada commands her to be taken away. She wasn't to be slain at the temple, but they take her away, and anyone who tried to support her was also to be killed, slay with the sword, whoever follows her. And they take her out and slay her. Now, we talked about this before, but there were sanctions in the book of Deuteronomy, for example, Deuteronomy 13, for the execution of idolaters. And not only was she an idolater, an open one, but of course she had murdered the heirs to the throne. I don't think there's any question that she was liable to death at this point. And I don't think you should get the impression that this was somehow a lynching. This wasn't a wild, irrational act of the mob, but completely in accordance with the justice that God had set up. So that takes us down, hurrying then, to verse 16. And here there's a statement that Jehoiada made a covenant between himself, the people, and the king, that they should be the Lord's people. This is the second in a series of four covenant renewals. We already saw the one in chapter 15, remember, with Asa. And the language is similar in chapter 15 as to what happens here, as are the consequences of the covenant. But I'd like to point out especially that great covenant theme which unifies the whole of the Bible, and that is that the covenant bond is stated that they should be the Lord's people. He will be our God and we will be his people. And that in the covenant renewal was the specific thing mentioned here in Chronicles. And so the covenant that's made was not, you might say, merely an ecclesiastical covenant, but also a civil covenant, but religious nonetheless. In other words, the king and the people bonded together to and agreed to serve the Lord the way the Lord had commanded them to do so. I think I won't say much more about the covenant renewal at this point, because we did talk about it in chapter 15. But that's a significant aspect and really the basis for what follows. The fact that they made this covenant renewal, that they pledged again to be the Lord's and to follow his ways, is the basis for what follows. Right.
Comment on that. When you read the history of the founding of this country, when the founding fathers, when they were going through the establishing of our government, they very much they would have hours of prayer in their meetings. I think one time it was like a day or so of prayer, kind of a sense of, you know, God's in charge of this whole thing. Mm-hmm. We're going, I mean, the Declaration of Independence is based on fact that God, the King of England, is subservient to God, and because he had acted outside of his authority, that was the justification these men had for writing the Declaration of Independence. It was not wasn't a set of rebellious people. They felt in God's eyes that they were justified to do what they did. So.
Yeah, that's sort of I'm getting to Lex Rex here, but that sort of idea had a long history. The development, that's good. What follows is, as I said, very similar to what followed in the account of the covenant renewal under Asa. That is, there's, you might say, a negative and a positive, although what those mean is not always clear. There's first the cleansing out of idolatry, and that reference there then in verse 17, especially to the going down to the Temple of Baal. You can imagine there was a Temple of Baal built there. Later on, of course, this becomes fairly common in the history of the Southern Kingdom even. But here, there was a temple built. They tear it down, and they execute the priest who was apparently insisting that he was going to stay by the altars. And they destroy the monuments of idolatry, you might say, the temple, the altars, and the images, and so forth. So that's one aspect. But you should also understand the verses that follow as connected with that. That is, not only did they put down the false religion, but they sought to restore the true worship of God. And that's something which, as we've seen, the chronicler emphasizes again and again. When true reformation comes, people will say, how did God tell us to worship and serve him? They don't just say, well, we got rid of those idols, let's think up something new. They say, how is it that God commanded it to be done? And so you see the references in verse 18 to the law of Moses and to David. And there's an emphasis here, which is, okay, I won't go through it again. We've seen it several times, but the fact that the restoration is in accordance with God's command. And that follows then through even down to the setting up of the gatekeepers. There was apparently a military function that the Levites had, and if not military, I guess you might say a police function. In secular terms, I guess you could say they were the bouncers, but surely that's putting it in too secular a way. They protected the temple from people who would enter in who were not allowed to enter in. And so that's the fact that there was a mixing in of the military here should be understood in the context that the Levites themselves had some police authority, at least for the protection of the temple. And that goes down then to verse 21, which we've already mentioned. The people of the land rejoiced. The city was quiet. That's a good thing in the chronicler's eyes. And that's that state of peace, or in this case of quiet, was something which was mentioned elsewhere in Chronicles as a blessing from God, because the usurper had been put down. You see, one other factor which is in the background of this is that this same destruction of Baal worship was taking place in the northern kingdom, or actually had taken place 6 years before, when Jehu, remember Jehu, the guy who drove furiously in his chariot, slew both actually the kings of the northern and southern kingdom. The next act he did was to purge Baal worship. And in this case, the southern kingdom was behind them by 6 years and trying to put that out. Now, I'd like to, in the end here, make a few comments about the significance of the covenant that was made, and the fact that there was apparently a separate covenant, not only this covenant renewal to be that the people should be the Lord's, but also with that a covenant between the people and the king. And that's made perhaps more explicit in the book of Kings, in the parallel account. That same statement of the covenant renewal, it says in verse 17 of 2 Kings 11, that Jehoiada made a covenant between the Lord, the king, and the people, that they should be the Lord's people, and also between the king and the people. And so there's an explicit statement that there was a covenant between the king and the people, which I think we can gather from Chronicles anyway, with reference to the earlier agreement for the restoration of Jehoiada. And I'd like to think about that a little bit. This passage and others like it have been important in the history of the outworking of biblical teaching on the civil magistrate. And in particular in Scotland, if you listen to the church history classes by tape or by audio, real audio, you'll know this, but that was an issue. What was the divine right of kings? What did it mean? Did it mean that the king was above the law? Did it mean that the people had any say in the appointment of the king? Did the king rule with the consent of the people? And those were issues which were discussed quite vigorously, beginning especially with Knox in Scotland. And the culminating work on the subject in Scottish church history is the book by Samuel Rutherford called Lex Rex, or The Law and the Prince. This is a very famous book and came to be influential. Brian has already mentioned, I think, one of the influences. Came to be influential, perhaps not directly, but indirectly through some other writers who wouldn't necessarily have shared all of Rutherford's convictions. Rutherford wrote very consciously in opposition to the claim by some that the king had no obligation directly to the people. The people really had no need to give consent to the rule of the king, and that the king was not in any sense under the law, but really, you might say, the final interpreter of the law, and perhaps because of that, over the law. So, I don't have time to read the whole book at this point, but I thought I would read just one statement. Samuel Rutherford, in making one of his points, makes this assertion. He says, "There is an oath betwixt the king and his people, laying on by reciprocation of bands." A band is a covenant or an oath-bound agreement. "Mutual civil obligation upon the king to the people, and the people to the king." So he proves that with several references, but in particular to this chapter in the parallel account in Kings, and argues that the way God set it up, there was an agreement between the king and the people. And this, the next part I was going to read goes back to what Brian said about the way the founding fathers viewed the king of England, I suppose, though not directly in religious terms. He says, "Religion is not given only to the king that he should keep it, but to all the inferior judges and people also in their kind. But because the estates never gave the king power to corrupt religion and press a false and idolatrous worship upon them, therefore when the king defendeth not true religion, but presseth upon the people a false and idolatrous religion, and that they are under the king, and that they are not under the king, insofar as he presses on them an idolatrous religion, but are presumed to have no king so far, and are presumed to have the power in themselves, as if they had not appointed any king at all." Them's fighting words, as they say. That's a statement that the king can lose his authority to govern by a violation of God's law. And this book then caused quite a stir, not because it was in a sense really new, but you can find statements like that in Calvin, even going back to the Institutes and his commentaries. But it caused quite a stir because the same issues were being raised in Scotland and in England. And so during the Westminster Assembly, it says, this is in the sketch of the life of Rutherford, I thought you'd enjoy this, "The work caused great sensation on its appearance," Bishop Guthrie mentions. Bishop Guthrie mentions that every member of the assembly, that's the Westminster Assembly, had in his hand that book lately published by Mr. Samuel Rutherford, which was so idolized that whereas Buchanan's treatise De Jure Regni Apud Scotos, this is a book that actually Jeff mentioned I think last week in his class, was written in the late 16th century, against the divine right of kings. Whereas that book was looked upon as an oracle before, this coming forth, it was slighted as not anti-monarchical enough, and Rutherford's Lex Rex only thought authentic. So, I think that was the case not because of a disagreement, but because Rutherford was addressing specific opinions which were raised at the time. Now, you may say, well, you know, why am I going into all this? I want to emphasize again that now, this isn't some dusty old book of Chronicles. This is relevant. The teaching here that the king does not have authority over the people inherent to himself. And if you want to replace king by the supreme ruler, I mean, in a sense it doesn't matter that it's the king, but the supreme ruler is bound in terms of a covenant obligation to the people. And that covenant obligation is spelled out in terms of a testimony, which is God's law. You see, that's a very fundamental fact. It's very important for understanding how civil government is to be set up. You could contrast that with what had been going on. Who was the ruler before? Well, the de facto ruler was Athaliah. You think she ruled under any constitution, any stated form of government? I mean, you can see the significance of this and the poignancy at this particular time for emphasizing that fact. When after 6 years of complete chaos and rule by one wicked woman, the emphasis here is on the fact that the king does not have the supreme authority. He can't act as he wishes. He is bound to serve in accordance with a covenant obligation to the people, and in particular that obligation is based on the truth of God's law. Okay, well, that's controversial. I know there's a lot more we could say, but see, I'm out of time, so I'm going to have to stop now. Any comments or questions? Seriously, if you have other reaction to it.
I was just thinking about the in the Constitution, our Constitution, their right to bear arms. If you read the language in there, the idea is that when this government that they set up gets outside of its jurisdiction and authority, that the people have a right to disregard that. I wondered if that
That comes up in here, certainly, and I think that would be, yeah. Yeah, I think the... I wouldn't say that that's particularly an issue here, but obviously they had to have some weapons to be able to do what they did. But certainly that sort of, at least the right of the people even to take up arms comes up in Lex Rex. This is Sprinkle. This is a facsimile copy. It's still available. And in fact, it has at the back that book that I mentioned by Buchanan, so it's a nice edition. It's kind of small print, double column, but it's a good book to have.
Just one other question. In verse 13, where it says, "So Athaliah tore her clothes," this idea of tearing your clothes, with her having a pedigree going back to pagan religion, is the tearing of clothes more a part of the pagan that was sort of picked up by Israel, or is it sanctioned as a way of, what I'm saying, expressing this rob?
I'm glad we have an expert here in Pastor Dorfel to answer questions like that. I think it's common to other religions, but I think I would also say that it's not pagan in the sense that sanctioned by God. Does that sound reasonable?
Oh yeah, the prophets
do. Yeah. In that sense, it's like circumcision, which was not limited to the nation. Well, that's a kind of a bad comparison. Circumcision wasn't limited to the nation of Israel, but it was set apart by God for a special sign of the covenant. And that would be another case of something which was common to other religions or cultures, but still had a significance in Israel's worship of God. Yeah, exactly, you know. Whether it was just for show or what is unclear, but that's an amazing statement, isn't it? Treason, treason. The cheek.
Isn't that typical, though?
Yeah, it is.
People who end up getting the same medicine that they've dished out, they somehow don't think they deserve it.
Yeah. It's funny, one of the commentators, I think it was Trapp, said this is exactly what the papists cry out when they, you know, they get kicked out of the whatever usurpation they have done. They say, oh, this is treasonous. So, yeah, I think it is a common reaction.